author of The Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Helen Dunmore, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
We are here on the occasion of the publication of Exposure, your latest book. Could you tell us the story of Exposure?
I can tell you some of it, yes. it's a novel set in the Cold War. It's about espionage, and it's about how the lives of spies impinge on everybody around them, friends, family, and how lives are torn apart, really, by treachery, by betrayal, by secrets, by suspicion.
Yes, because there's many levels of exposure.
There are.
And there's good levels of secrets. There's good aspects of secrets. There's aspects of the secrets that they enjoy. If we're talking about spies and the joy and the pleasure of having, you know, of being in a private club. And that seems to sustain some of them. But you can't have a secret without the risks of secrets, which is exposure.
And also having a double life, hiding yourself. As you say, there is a thrill in it, perhaps, at the beginning. But it's also very corrosive because you are trapped within that and you're moving all the time farther and farther and farther away from a candid world into a world of double shadows.
And at every opportunity that you have to tear those self-made walls, those self-made secret walls down, you're trapped.
You are trapped. And I wanted to show, too, the sordidity of betrayal, that people are tied up, stuffed into the back of cars, that they die brutally, that it's not a matter of glamour and drama and high living. It's something that breaks lives, and particularly breaks the lives of those who are intimately connected with the spies.
Yes, this is not the world of 007.
No.
This is more the gritty world of Smiley's People and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the sort of seamy underbelly.
It is the underbelly, and it's also about what happens within friendship and family when suddenly someone is taken away, is arrested, or is exposed as an agent, and everything you thought you knew about that person is stripped away, like a tree having all its leaves stripped off. And you ask not only who were they, but also who was I? Was I in love with a real thing or with a lie? Where am I now? Where's my solid ground?
And there's different exposures in this. One, as you say, it's a Cold War story, and the biggest one is being exposed as a spy. But there's homosexuality, male and female, that would create the same sense of expulsion and shame, which go with exposure. There's also class comes into it to a big degree. And I don't know if that's not necessarily exposure, but it does play a role, as does one of the characters being foreign.
It does. You're right. Sexuality is very important in the novel, and because it begins in 1960, that is when homosexual acts between consenting adults were illegal in the UK, and so the penalties, imprisonment, public shaming, losing a job, losing your friendships, losing your family, it was so horrific. And we forget very quickly what that world was like, what that era was like. But it governed people's behaviour. It also led to blackmail and to knowledge being used as leverage so that people could be forced to do things because you had something on them. And often they were sexual secrets. And those could not be brought into the light. It seems like another world now. But maybe if we were to think, what is it in the present that we use as leverage and we use to put pressure onto people? We wouldn't, you know, we would look back at that era and we would understand how terrifying it must have been.
The same, you know, the same level of punishment and public shame as being exposed as a Russian spy was put on you for being homosexual. Almost.
Yeah, I mean, you probably would spend longer in jail as a Soviet spy, but there was that sense again that your life could be taken away from you. And the threat at the beginning of the novel, when a man is removed, he's arrested, he's taken away under suspicion of espionage, and his family is left completely aghast. And how are they going to carry on? How are they going to carry on without his earnings? How are they going to carry on suddenly in the cold wind of public shame? And so the central female character, Lily, who is the mother, and she is now becoming the sole protector, the sole support, the one who must think and plan and plot and protect and manoeuvre. And in fact, Lily turns out herself to be very, very good at hiding things.
Yes, she's an adept agent within her own family and for the protection of her own family.
She is. She is the one who makes fewest mistakes. Compared to the professional spies, she's pretty successful.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
One of the things that you touched upon there with the leverage of homosexuality, but the differing levels of loyalties and conflicting loyalties create a lot of problems for the characters as well.
Absolutely. People have Lily has a huge loyalty to the home, the family, to her husband Simon. And because she's been a child refugee, she's once lost everything. She's lost her home, her language, her father. She has almost lost her life. She is not going to let anything threaten that. So her loyalty to that is absolute. And she becomes very, very, very tough, almost fearsome in her protection of those she loves. But loyalty is also a very mixed quality. We have Giles is on one level, he's a betrayer. On another level, towards the end of the novel, he does display a deeper, more profound loyalty. But he is a traitor. He is a traitor in that he is a Soviet spy. He's a traitor in that he betrays the people he loves. So how does he reconcile all those things? It's an agonizing process for him.
And something that we were saying is that he is immobilized through much of the plot. And he has to spend a lot of time digging deep within his psyche. And he spends the time and he plumbs the depths. And out of that becomes a sort of redemptive love.
You're right. He's always been afraid of disgrace. And yet he's flirted with it. He's courted it. He's walked on the edge. He likes the edge. He likes to go to a party and be the centre of everyone's attention and be joking and laughing and to know himself that he is not what he appears and yet to be in a position where he's drawing attention. He's no shy, quiet spy who's in the corners. He absolutely wants to be centre stage. And then when he's immobilised and he realises that all that has fallen away and that he no longer has anything, almost everything has gone. There's very little left. He's had a fall. Towards the beginning of the novel, he falls. And that's a literal fall, a metaphorical fall, a real agonising crushing of bone and life. And that's what he has to come to terms with.
You also talked about Lily. Against all the odds, everyone and all of the evidence and enormous pressure on her to give up her husband, to give in to the idea that he is a traitor, drop him, save her family. And she doesn't. And she does find incredible resource within her. And it occurred to me that that could go either way as well. You know, when people say, he's bad for you, you should leave him. And, you know, the proof is only in the pudding. You know, it's only afterwards we know if that was the right decision or not the right decision. And, of course, we are not going to give that away here and now. Mm.
Lily is a character who has, as I've said already, she's been formed by traumatic experiences of childhood, by knowing that nothing is safe, everything can be taken from you. She has known what it's like to go into the street as a child and to be hated. And she has known that had she stayed longer in Germany, had her mother not decided, this is the moment, go now, she would be dead. And her father has been hesitating and not sure and no, nothing's going to be all right, nothing's going to happen. And her mother has acted. And Lily has carried that in her. And she has known that at a certain point in life, there's no room for hesitation, there's no room for equivocation. And also there's no room for listening to others. You have to listen to your inner self that says, go now or do this. And she's quite, and sometimes she really allows her instincts, her animal self, to tell her what to do. And when she feels fear, when she feels her skin prickling and crawling, she knows. And she doesn't pretend that she doesn't know. So I really liked exploring this strength and this... I suppose it's a digging and it's a discovery and a character who is finding so much and needing to find so much and is so alone.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And it's a very different strength than certain other characters rely on. Julian Cloud, for example, and Simon Collington's family. These are other characters, but Simon Collington's family in particular can draw upon years of position.
Yes.
And the not intangible strength that lends them, which is not something that Lily believes in. She's seen that can disintegrate in a day.
Mm. She has. She's seen that it doesn't work. You know, you may have possessions, you may have position, you may have qualifications, and it can all be taken away from you. The Callingtons haven't had that, and they are quite difficult people because they're arrogant and they know what's what.
Unassailable.
They believe so. They believe so. And they have, in fact, formed almost a united front against Lily and against Simon, her husband, even though he's her son because he's not quite one of us in that terrible expression. So she has to resist them. She has to resist them. And the pressure to direct her life and take her children and form the narrative, really, of what's going to happen next, because they're the kind of people who always know what the right thing is to do, but it really isn't the right thing at all.
Yes, and she is served by her sort of scrappy, sort of need for survival. You know, she is served by that.
She is. Indeed, it's survival. She knows how to do that. And she also knows how to size up an adversary very quickly. For example, her employer, who is was described by one reviewer as a cowardly martinet, which I thought was a wonderful description, who is really wanting to sack her because she's a part-time teacher. And, you know, the parents really can't have anybody who's associated with Simon Callington and the accusations that are facing him, that, you know, she must go. And she is not going to let that happen to her because she knows how serious it would be to have a dismissal on her record. And she just takes control of the situation and turns it very smoothly into herself saying, well, I'm going to need to resign for personal reasons because of I'm moving to another. And she does it with real attack. And I feel, yes, Lily is thinking on her feet and she's finding resources in her because she's had to think on her feet a lot.
Yes. You excel in creating atmosphere and in exposure, you know, the sort of still the whiff of the post-war privation, coal and rain and rationing and cigarettes and the joy of little extravagances like beer and flowers. Where do your stories begin?
They probably do begin with character, but also with the atmosphere that you've described. For me, that was the atmosphere is almost a character in itself. It has to have that darkness. It has to have shadows under trees, pavements glistening with rain, looking out of a window. That might be a lamppost or it might be a figure just beginning to move. The tang of coal in the air, the noises of the city, and you use the word privation, and I think that is true because it's still an exhausted country. There are still bomb sites. There are still children are quite hardy. People are used to physical work. Houses are not warm. School life is quite tough. I wanted that's all part of the climate in which the story grows.
Mm. You can sort of feel the steam rising off, you know, tweed coats. And I loved the image of their London house, that it felt, you know, like a ship surging in the night.
Mm. Yes, it's a little place of refuge, but there's a very wild sea out there.
Well, it's a period that you've lived through. Does it have particular resonance for you?
I think what I would say is it connects quite strongly with other books I've written, because I've written The Siege, which was set in the Second World War in the Soviet Union, and then The Greatcoat, which is set during that period in the UK. And I've written about the Cold War before, but from a Soviet perspective in The Betrayal. So it's a period that I've dwelt on, thought about, found imaginatively very stirring and interesting. And I don't think I could probably have written Exposure without those other books, because that's given me an ease with the period and an ease with where we are in history, where people are in their sense of themselves, which makes it possible to go into the book at quite a sharp angle.
Yes, because we look at history with perspective and from a remove. And it's always different when it's personal. And when you zero in on how it's experienced, as opposed to how it's read in books. And you have both of those perspectives.
Exactly. I want that feeling of that it's felt on the pulse. It's something, you know, it's in the marrow, it's in the blood. It's not something removed. And also it's not something that the characters can yet place. They don't know where they are in history. None of us knows. We are just inhabiting the present and we are adrift in the present, really. And, of course, we are inclined to look back and be quite deterministic about where people were and what they thought and what they felt, and as if they knew what was coming afterwards, but they don't know. And they don't know Lily and her friend Erica. They don't know that there isn't going to be a catastrophic nuclear war. They don't know that they don't know what's going to happen. And that is something I love to do, which is create characters who really do dwell in their own time, not in a world of hindsight.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station, where you'll only hear the female voice.
But I want to talk about, because you've had a very long career, and you were the inaugural Orange Prize winner, which is now the Bailey's Prize for Women, for your book A Spell of Winter. That was 20 years ago. Evoke the atmosphere of that time for me and how that changed
when that
you.
Prize was first.
Yeah.
That was a very interesting time because there was a lot of disagreement and argument about that prize.
Still is.
Even more then. There were many articles about, was it justifiable? Was it reasonable? Was it unfair to men? Was it something that we could take seriously? There were many, many. And the people who were organising and running the prize were absolutely determined, and they showed steel. They never wavered. And they were determined that it was going to be a big prize. And one way to do that, of course, is have a very glitzy, very, very glitzy launches. And the prize-giving ceremony, which I remember very well because it was a big, big event at the Liberal Club, and it was just so buoyant, so effervescent, such a sense of we've got this, we've done this, this is a celebration of what women do in fiction, not just a celebration of the shortlisted or the long-listed writers, but what women write, and that that is important and it's worth us putting huge effort into. I think it's changed the climate over the years. For me, I would say that was certainly true. For readers, we have now, you know, there's so many offshoots from that prize, so many reading groups, so many activities drawing readers together. So I think it has been quite transformative.
And for you personally?
Oh, for me personally, it was a very big thing because it's brought my books to a level of attention that they hadn't had before. It was an enormous amount of publicity, which, whether that leads people to read your books or not, they know your name. I think it took me, you know, it took me to another level of recognition, which no author really feels sad about.
It would be churlish to be upset about it. And did it put pressure on your writing in any way?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I found it helpful because there was more sense of there's a readership there. There are people who want to read your books, the people who will follow your work. And that is, it's heartening and enlivening.
And with you immersing yourself so much through your writing in other times and in other lives, how do you inhabit your present?
Very easily. Very easily. Now, I don't find that is a distance. Certainly, when I'm working on a book, I am very preoccupied, and I will walk along and I will be thinking, and I will be... In my mind, there will be perhaps a passage going through and I'm thinking that's not quite right, that needs to be sharpened, that dialogue's not quite right, Lily wouldn't say that, Charles wouldn't do that, and I'm in that world. But then at one point, the world has to be closed. You know, I have to finish it. I have to finally finish editing, which I love to do. So the editing is a joy, really, and I could go on endlessly just honing, edging the book. But the point comes when I have to say, no, that's for you now, that's for someone else.
Mm. And we get to bring it to life with our reading.
Exactly.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Helen.
Thank you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.